Okay, you're tuned to WHPK 88.5 FM in Chicago. You are listening to the Sitting in the Park show. Today is going to be a special show because I have on the phone right now a singer named Kenneth Jones. He sang in a bunch of Chicago groups and had a long career after that too. So we will be talking about his musical career and playing the records that he recorded, which are all great records. So you should definitely keep tuned. So first of all, can you hear me, Kenneth?
Yes, I can hear you.
Okay, great. So first of all, are you originally from Chicago?
I'm originally from Grand Rapids, Michigan, believe it or not.
When did you come to Chicago?
I came to Chicago in 63.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And what part of Chicago did you stay?
South Side Chicago, over by the Ickes Projects and the Hilliard Projects.
Is that like 24th and State around there?
Wow, you're killing me. 22nd and State.
22nd and State, okay. Mm-hmm. So how'd you get involved with music?
I got involved with music when I was 9, 10 years old. My dad used to sing and practice with Sam Cooke, Al Green, and the Mighty Clouds of Joy. And my father was a deacon in church, so he would come. They would have practice at our house for the shows that they would go out and do for church. He was a spiritual singer. My father is Kenneth Jones. His spiritual group was The Wings of Faith.
Did they ever record anything?
Yeah, they had a few records out at the time. They used to sing with the Salem Travelers and the Pilgrim Travelers and the Soul Stirrers with Sam Cooke. And I really enjoyed it. I remember when I was a kid, I used to he would take me with him to the rehearsals. And every time he did, I was about tall as his knee, probably a little taller than his knee. And he would let me come up in a circle with them while they practiced, and I would grab a hold of his leg, and he would just be, you know, how they pat their foot, and I'd be bumping up with his foot rhythm. And so the reason why he would bring me, because they would always like for me to come, because I can imitate. I could imitate everybody in his group. And he would say, Kenny, do Lonnie. And I'd do Lonnie. And Kenneth, do Scott now. And I'd do, and they just have a ball at their breaks when they had their breaks. So that's how I really started liking the music.
Okay. And when did you first decide to sing either by yourself or with your own group? When did that happen, in high school or before high school?
It happened before high school, because when I was younger, I remember everywhere my daddy would go, I would always want to go with him. And when we'd get in the car, he would play the radio, and I would be listening to songs like by the Drifters or the Four Seasons. And I think, really, that's a good question you asked me, because that is the very first song I heard by the Four Seasons was Sherry. Sherry, Sherry, baby. And I remember sitting in the back of the car, and that came on. I thought that was the greatest song in the world. And I remember I knew that was a hit then. I didn't know what hits were. So that's when I really started liking music and started trying to teach my brother, Lauren Jones, how to sing and make harmony and all that kind of stuff. And that's when I really started focusing on music.
So was your brother younger than you?
Yes, I'm the oldest of all my brothers and sister.
How many brothers do you have?
I got three brothers, Larry, Vic, and Chip, and my sister Gigi.
And Lauren was the one that initially sang with you, is that right?
Yes, I worked with him all my life, I guess. You know, when I was in fourth grade, I remember my first instrument was a trumpet, a cornet, really. And I never forget how I loved the cornet. I thought it was so cool to have a horn, you know, with a case. And I would go home, and I would love to practice. And when my mother and father, they would leave out and go to the store or go grocery shopping or something, I'd be up in my room with the cornet or the trumpet. And I remember I couldn't read music fast enough, so I would try to play what I hear. And Duke of Earl was playing, was one of my favorite songs by Gene Chandler. And I remember taking the trumpet, and I learned the whole horn arrangement just by listening to it. And when my parents got home, I couldn't wait to come get them, go get them and bring them upstairs to my room and show them what I learned on my own. I didn't know not one note, but I could play everything. I could play the whole horn arrangement. So in doing that, that's when I learned how to teach my brother a harmony and steps. That's when I started learning, you know, doing choreography.
Okay. So when did you first form a vocal group?
The first vocal group I formed is when my mother and father divorced in Grand Rapids, and she moved us to Gary, Indiana. And I would say from Gary, Indiana, we moved to Chicago. It was like 62, 63. And Jesus Christ, I said 62, 63. And
was that the Flares, the first group you formed?
No, the first group was the Concerts, and that was me, my brother, Early Granberry, and my Lauren Jones, and my brother Vic Jones. That was our first group, and then when we got to Chicago and moved down by the projects, where the Icky's projects and the Hilliard projects. I met Kenny Beckwith, Danny Givens, and Walter Hughes, and me and my brother, and we were standing in front of the projects. We didn't know anybody. We had just, you know, got there. And because of the Concerts, the group that I formed off of Indiana Street, 58th in Indiana, we met these guys, and they came over to the projects because we were new and the projects were new, the Hilliards. And we were standing outside and they came over and we heard some groups. In those days, groups would sing anywhere. They were singing in the stores, on the train, on the bus. And we were standing out in front of the projects and they were trying to sing a little bit. And I was pretty good. I was always talented. And so I walked over to him, and we got to talking to Kenny Beckwith, Danny Givens, and Walter Hughes. And I told them about where I came from and about my dad and how my music thing was. And they sounded pretty good. They could make some harmony. So I said, well, let me go upstairs and get my brother. So I went upstairs, got my brother. We came back down, and we sung Ooh Baby Baby, you know, right then. And that's where we became the Flares.
So what, do you remember what year that was?
That was probably, let me see, we got there 63, we lived over there 64, about between 64, 65, somewhere in there.
Were you in high school at that point?
We were, yes, we had just started high school.
What school did you go to?
Dunbar High School.
And I was a little confused. Were the other members also from the Icky Homes, that area, or were
yes?
Okay,
they were. They were. They were from the Ickies, and my mother moved into the Hilliards, which was across the street, which was a brand new project. I never really liked to call them project because they were so new, but you know, I guess in the end, that's all it was just a big project. It was just new. I guess because when the Ickies was first form, I heard they told me it used to be really nice and beautiful too, you know.
Yeah, I think they all start out nice,
yeah.
And they aren't well maintained.
Yeah.
So you started singing with those guys, and were there other groups from your neighborhood that kind of inspired you, or were you competed with?
You know, I didn't really. I wasn't into that at the time when I made the group, the Flares. I just wanted to carry on when my dad and my mother divorced and separated. I was really so hurt. I was so taken back with that, and I wanted to, you know, some kind of way always let my dad know that, you know, I'm doing the same thing that he was doing. I'm born May the 12th. He's born May the 12th. I was born on his birthday. And I wanted to show my father and my mother, for that fact, that, you know, I could do the same thing my dad does, because I really loved music as far as when I watched him do his shows and watched how he rehearsed I knew what was going on in the rehearsal. Then to go out and actually see them perform it, it was just like magic. I couldn't believe it. So I've always liked that. So that's what happened when I formed the group. I wanted to, you know, do the same thing he was doing because I loved doing it.
So you're saying you were mainly inspired by your father and not other groups that were around the
neighborhood? Yeah, because I didn't know about other groups. I didn't know any other groups. You know what I mean? I didn't know. So my mind wasn't there. I wasn't focused on competing and all that. I just wanted to sing songs by the Miracles, Smokey Robinson and the Miracles, and you know what I mean? And all the groups.
I know there were a lot of groups from Stateway Gardens, which was a little bit south of you.
Right.
The Lost Generation were from there.
Right.
Did you have any contact with those groups once you started performing?
When, you know, it's funny that once what happened, and this is it in a nutshell, we had learned songs by, you know, like I said, Smokey Robinson and the Miracles and different groups, Temptations and all that. And I thought we were good enough to go to the Regal, which is the same thing as the Apollo Theater in New York. The Regal was the same equivalent to that here there in Chicago. And we got booed off the stage. That was the first time I had ever been booed. I was so...
It was like the weekly talent show you had?
Exactly. It was like just like this show on the Apollo Theater where every Wednesday you have a talent night. And I went there with my flares, and we got up there and we tried to sing, I can remember the song, It's the World of Fantasy.
The Five Stair Steps.
And the band there was I can't think of his last name.
The Red Saunders.
Red Saunders. Oh, yeah. You really know your stuff, man. And we got up there. They called us out. We was all so nervous. We didn't know leadership. Everything we practiced, when we hit that stage, that was the first time I had ever been on stage like that. When we hit the stage, we lost it. We couldn't remember nothing. One guy was looking this way. One guy did something over here. One guy was singing something over here. And it was horrible. And I remember the people going, boo, boo. And the Mr. Sandman, whatever that guy with the cane and stuff, the clown, he came out and took us off the stage. I was so, no. So what I did from that day, and this is where it all started, I made them practice every day. I promise you, I'm not lying to you. We practice every day. Christmas, Thanksgiving, every day for 1 year.
Okay.
For one full year. And then when we were so good at practice that now it makes sense when Albert Iverson says, practice, we're talking about practice. Yeah, you got to practice. So we dedicated ourselves because I said to myself, I will never let that happen to me again. And we went back the next year to the Regal Theater, got on the talent show, and we was on that talent show with Michael Jackson and the Jackson 5. They were just the Jackson 5. Michael was 9 years old. I'll never forget as long as I live. We got back on that show. We got on that stage. And I remember Michael was a little guy. He was standing in the wings because they were going to go out before we were going to go out. And they called them out, and they killed it. They just tore the place up. They sung, I got to see you somehow, not tomorrow, but right now. They sung a blues song. Michael Jackson sung blues when he was 9 years old. It killed him. And it was called a Slip Away. So we came out behind them and sung the artistic song, Hey Girl, I Want You. And we tied for first place with the Jackson 5. And then we had to come back the next week to break the tie at another talent show. And Michael Jackson and the Jackson 5, they never showed up. They got called by Bobby Taylor in Vancouver somewhere, and they went to Canada, whatever. We came back, and we sung Hello, Young Lovers by the Temptations a cappella. and we won first place.
So was that around 68, something like that?
69? That was, yeah, about probably around that time. And then that's when all the competitiveness in me and other groups, that's when all that happened in my life.
Were you still in high school at the time?
I was still in high school. I was probably a sophomore in high school. I was playing football in high school.
So you were like 17, something like that?
Yes, sir. That's exactly what it was. I'll never forget that as long as I live. And when we won first place, we won a trophy. David Ruffin gave us the trophy. We won a couple of bucks, and they let us open up for Bobby Blue Bland at the Club de Lisa.
Okay. So eventually you ended up cutting a record, right? I called I Want You and All I Need as your first record.
Exactly. That was the first song I ever tried to put some lyric to music, and we were with the Statistics.
Were they the band?
And that was the band. And they were a real good band at that time, and I was really honored that they would even play behind us. And they lived in the Wentworth Gardens.
Okay.
You hit the Wentworth Gardens, right?
Yeah, it's right where Comiskey is.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. We got hooked up with them, and I think that's how we got hooked up with Donnell Glover.
So you were
at Southtown Records.
Yeah, so and he had a bunch of groups. He had some group called The Auditions, and he had a bunch of groups back then. So you're saying you had the band first, and the band hooked you up with Darnell?
Yeah, some kind of way we met. I can't even remember now how we really met, but I knew it was through that because he lived in the same Wentworth Gardens with them.
Okay.
And some kind of way I met him first, because he through Sidney Foster. Sidney Foster was a manager. He managed us, and he knew Darnell. That's how I was. And then some kind of way we hooked up with Darnell, and then Darnell hooked us up to the Statistics, and then. That's when he wanted us to record, and I remember this because I can't read or write music. To this day, I can't read or write music, but I remember writing the lyrics to music with the Statistics, and that's where we come up with I Want You.
Okay, well, let me play the record, and we could talk a little bit more.
Okay.
So this is the Flares with their very first record, and a really nice Chicago sound on this. This track is called I Want You.
Thank you.
Okay, that was just the Flares with their very first record called I Want You, and that got released on the Southtown record label, which I think was run by a guy named Danny Glover, who Candice was talking about before I played the record, and it had a really nice kind of classic Chicago sound from that time. So, Candice, do you remember what year that came out?
I guess it had to be 67 or 68, somewhere in there, because I remember I never graduated from high school in 69, and so it had to be like 67 or something.
And the lineup on the record is let me just say this so it's correct, is Ken Beckwith, Danny Givens, Walter Hughes, Kenneth Jones, and Lauren Jones. Is that right?
Exactly. And you said something else that is, I like what you said, it's a classic sound. And the reason why you're right is because the Stair Steps was happening at the time. We were trying to sound like the Stair Steps. The Admirations was happening at the time, and they sounded like the Stair Steps. So all that stuff around there became, instead of, it wasn't, I didn't like doo, I like doo-wop, don't get me wrong, but I wanted to be different. I wanted to be a little more modern. The Whispers was happening at the time, and nobody really knew the Whispers. Whispers had great songs back in the 60s. They had some bomb songs.
Yeah, I played their 60s records on my show a lot.
They were a fantastic
group, yeah.
Yeah, so when you say classic, you're correct. Very correct.
So, and one thing I didn't ask you is how'd you get the name The Flares?
When we had to make up a name for the group, when we won, before we got to the Regal, we tried to come up with a good name for ourselves. And I liked the Flares because I can still see it in my mind. You know how I like the fireworks flare out,
okay,
type of thing? And so that's what I thought we were, that people would always, when they see the Flares, we would have, I think the eye, we made the eye like a candle, like or something, like a flare. And I always thought that was the visual thing of that people would always remember us. So that's how we came up with the Flares. We all agreed the Flares would be a good name for us.
And did that record come out after you won the talent show?
Yes.
And did it get any play on the radio? I know it's a real obscure
record. Yeah, we got some airplay. Mr. Glover, Darnell. Darnell Glover. He actually had a radio show like you got.
Okay.
And so he used to have us come on there and do little interviews, and then he'd get shows for us. We played a lot at DuSable High School. We performed at Phillips High School, Dunbar High School, Harlan High School. And we were getting really, really popular because we would win all the talent shows that we did. We won them. And then we stopped doing talent shows, and we started doing variety shows where we would be Darnell Glover. He would have produced shows where we would be the main attraction that night. It could be 9-10 groups.
Yeah,
acts.
I know he had a lot of groups under him. Like he had that group, the Auditions that I mentioned before.
Yeah, I used to like them guys. They was pretty good. He had the. What's the other group he had?
He had a group called the Nation Survivors.
And what's the other one, though? When you said that name, it blew my mind. I forgot about them.
There was a Shadow of Shades that was the band.
What's that group? Submiracle Temp.
Oh, yeah, they were like a Wentworth Gardens or Statewood
exactly,
Gardens.
Exactly,
yeah.
Something like that. I remember them, and they had a guy in a group they used to call him Sexy Rexy. It was so much fun. But I thought that was interesting that they could come up with Sub-Miracle Temps. That's pretty cool. That was pretty cool.
Yeah, that group is interesting because every single group I interview from, like Stateway Gardens area, uh-huh, always talks about them, even though they never cut a record. So
that's funny because they always put on a good show. They were a good performing group.
Yeah, I bet that we're a great group since everybody talks about them.
Yeah, and I forgot about the Auditions. That's right, the Auditions, and I saw that on your website when you do your interviews. I saw the Auditions.
I haven't found the Auditions yet. I'm still working for them.
And they were out of, I think it was either Wentworth Gardens or Stateway. I think it was Stateway.
Okay. Yeah, Yeah, if you think of anyone who might know any of them, I'm still looking for them.
I'll help you, because what you're doing is a real good thing, man. I really appreciate that you can do this and try to catch some of these guys to see what they're doing today. And that's why I was very interested in doing the interview with you, so that people that remember me, I hope somebody call in and remember me, and that we can talk, or I'd like to see. Because I lived in Chicago. I grew up there, as far as I'm concerned. That was my town, my home. I was sleeping outside. I used to sleep out at Grand Park where Obama did his
rally.
Yeah. And I used to sleep out of that park. I wrote my first song that I actually wrote where I knew what I was doing, to show you how life is.
Okay. Well, yeah, we'll get to all that stuff, too.
Okay.
One thing I wanted to ask about is you cut a second record as the Flares.
Right.
On a label called Rap, and that track was called Where You Live, and You Got to Steal It.
Exactly.
What's the story with that? Were you still with Darnell Glover? Because I think that label was run by James Shelton.
James Shelton, I hope he's still around.
He's still around.
Is he?
Yeah.
I hope he's listening tonight. I was going to ask you if since you know some of these people that I know, just to make them aware that I was going to be on tonight. But how it happened with Mr. Shelton, look at me, I still call him Mr. Shelton. I like that. When I was outside in the streets, sleeping in the streets, okay, and let me clear this up. My mother moved away from me while I was working. I quit school because I got my girlfriend pregnant. So I quit school to show her parents that I was not a guy. I wasn't raised that way. I was going to stay, take care of the baby and her and all that, and I'd find me a job. And I thought that was the right thing to do. And my mother didn't think that was the right thing to do. So she showed me, okay, you want to be grown? All right, you're going to be grown. And she left. So that's it with that. I was out there in the streets, and I didn't have nowhere to. I didn't know how to take care of myself. I was too young to get a place. I was 18. So I just walked the streets all night, and that's when God. I thought nobody loved me. My mother was gone. I know where my dad was at. My brothers and sisters were gone. My mother. So I was just out there, man. And I remember, I would pray every night, and thank God my parents introduced me to Christ when I was a little guy. So I went to him. That's all I could do. I would sleep out in front of the projects on the bench, sleep on elevators, sleep in the vestibules. I would, when it got pretty cold, I would go and sleep in like Lake Meadows, because it was warm in the vestibule, and I would sit on the heater. When it was nice out, I would just walk all night long. That's why I say Chicago is my home. I know every inch of Chicago, because I would walk all night, and I would cry, and I would pray, and I would cry. And then God started just giving me songs. Songs would just come up out of me, and I didn't think about, songs to sing to be rich or famous or any of that. I sung songs. Or created, or he allowed, I was available for him to come into me. And God, that's what he does. You have a broken heart, he comes in and mends it. So you know it's him and not mankind. So even though I was out there doing that, I would make up songs as I walk. So, and then before you know it, it would be dawn. And when I wrote, songs would come out of me. I would go find a school or some place where I can find a piano. I could not read or write music, but I could. When I found a piano, I'd put music, you know, with chords and try to
make a melody.
Make a melody with it, like we'll get to that. But I just want to get that clear. That's how it happened. I didn't know I even had this kind of talent. I didn't know that.
You're saying you discovered your songwriting ability.
Exactly.
When you were living on the street.
And so what happened was, one day, it was cold, I'll never forget it, and I went into James Shelton's hotel, and he had a piano in the lobby. So I went and sat down and tried to practice some of the songs that I had, you know, came up with when I could get to a piano. That was my whole thing then, is to get to a piano, because I could be walking the streets. I made up a song called Next time she'll be good. There's a girl sitting on the bitch crying the blues.
Which the eight minutes having to do.
And then so Mr. Yeah. Shelton, he heard me. And he goes, wow, that's pretty good, you know. And he said, you have a group? I said, yeah. And I was singing with the Flares. I was in the street. I couldn't sleep with them or stay with them because their parents, like, you know, they knew my mother left me and everything. And I was out there. So they give me sandwiches and bologna sandwiches, chicken. They sneak food out to me, that kind of thing. And so Shelton said, I tell you what, you don't have a place. You're really too young to stay here. You have to be at least 21. I was just 18 or 17. He said, I'm going to give you a place, Kenny. And he did. He gave me a room, let me have a room. And he told me if I would practice with my group to learn some songs, I mean, to make up some songs to some tracks that he had when he had the Shy Lights. And that's where Do You Live came. I wrote that in his hotel, and I also wrote You Got to Steal It in his hotel. That's how that happened.
I think Jerlene Shelton's name is on those records.
I think so, too. You're right.
Do you remember working with her on those?
No, I didn't. All I remember is he said he had the Shy Lights, and they were supposed to record those to those tracks. And something happened where they all fell out, and they got with Brunswick.
Okay.
And he had those tracks, and he gave them to me. And I took them home. I mean, I took them, and I showed the group those tracks. And then I wrote those songs to the tracks and then took it back to Mr. Shelton. And he fell in love with them. And
yeah,
that's the recorders.
Yeah, that's interesting that they might have ended up as Shy Lights tracks.
I know. Isn't that something?
Let me play. Both sides of this are really good, too. But let me play the Where You Live side,
yeah,
and we can talk some more.
Pretty popular for us.
So this is the Flares with their second record called Where You Live. Okay, that was just the Flares with their second record, another really nice Chicago sound called Where You Live. And if you're just tuning in, I have Kenneth Jones on the phone right now talking about his groups and his recording career. So we were just talking about how James Shelton kind of discovered him when he was just playing the piano. Was it in the lobby of his hotel?
Right, it was in the lobby of his hotel.
And he recorded that record with you, and you were no longer, were you still with your with Darnell Glover as a manager?
No, we kind of went through some changes, and it kind of felt, we fell out with him, and like I said, I was still sleeping outside. I was still homeless, and I never looked at myself as homeless. I just looked at myself as a person trying to survive every day. And I'm so glad that my grandmother instilled that in me. She said, Kenneth, you have it in you, and they can't take it from you. You got it in you. And I never forgot that. And she told me the greatest war, she always said, Kenneth, just remember, if me and your grandfather made it through the Depression, you can make it through these times.
It's amazing that you managed to keep making music at that time.
I know, even the guys in my group will say, man, it seemed like the more worse it gets for you, Kenny, the more stronger you get. And I was always uplifting to them. I was always, that's why I became a good leader, as well as the Hard Knocks and the reality of it all made me a student, you know, where I had to learn the hard way on everything, but I always turned out to be a good leader. I was always able to be a good people person. I have good people skills. I can deal with whites. I can deal with the blacks. I can deal with the Mexicans. I always could do that, and I always found comedy. I do little light stand-up when I play now, too, and I've always like to joke and see people laugh and be happy. I like to see kids happy. I like to see old people still holding hands and still being romantic. And that's why I got over 400 songs, man, and I wrote them while I was out in the streets, you know.
So that record we just played, though, Where You Live, was it the same lineup of the group singing on it, all five guys?
That was DuBois Shelton, Walter Hughes, me, Danny Gibbons wasn't there, Pete Kenny wasn't there, my brother wasn't there, and it was Quinn, I can't remember Quinn's last name, but it was Quinn, me, Walter Hughes, Walter Outley, and Richard Burt, who passed away.
How do you spell his last name? Burt?
Burton, like...
Oh, Burton, okay. Mm-hmm. So that wasn't the Velvet lineup, that was actually the...
That was the Flares.
The second Flares record is DuBois Shelton, Walter
right.
Hughes...
Richard Burton.
Richard Burton and...
Quinn.
And you,
right.
Kenneth Jones.
Yeah.
So the lineup actually changed a lot. Do you know how that happened or what happened?
Well, Danny... I think he went to the service.
Okay.
That happened there. And me and Kenny, when I was sleeping outside, I remember they wanted, Kenny would like me, let me sleep with them, or his mother let me come in. And then something happened between us with all that stuff, and I don't want to go into no deepy thing, but, and so we separated, so Kenny wasn't singing with me anymore. And it was like, well, you're sleeping outside anyway, so bye. So,
your brother wasn't on the record
and
either.
And my brother wasn't. He went with my mother.
Okay.
Remember when my mother left, she took all my brothers and sisters with her. So Walt and them, we was all still tight, and they was like, they felt honored that I would even come to them and say, look, y'all want to sing with me? And yeah, they left their groups. They had the Rotations. Walt was singing with the Rotations. DuBois was singing with the Infatuations. And but they all admired me because I would put steps together. I was popular throughout Chicago for doing shows and all the shows that we did. And we opened up for a lot of people, too. So they became the Flares for me.
Yeah, I interviewed the Rotations. I didn't realize that they had a connection to your group.
Yeah. Walter Outley was one of the head members. Malcolm Smith and Greg Clark, Terry Irons, they were and Norman Felton, the Rotations. They were good. They were good too. We did a lot of shows with them. But me and Walt got real tight. He's, matter of fact, he's my best friend, and he came over and we kept the Flares together.
Okay. So did that record get any play on the radio?
Which one are you talking about?
The second one, the Where You Live.
Where You Live, we got some airplay.
Okay.
We did get some airplay. And it wasn't great airplay, but we heard it time, you know, here and there, and we were doing shows behind it.
What were some of the places you were doing shows at?
We sung at the Boy, do you remember? Is it still there? The Mark V? That was out there off of 75th and Cottage or something. We sung that. We did a lot of stuff at high schools, too, with the song. Some of the places I can't remember now, but they were all clubs. The Green Bunny, we performed at the Green Bunny. Is that still there, man?
Everyone talks about it, but I don't think it's there anymore.
Okay, and it was one off of 69th off the freeway there off of the Dan Ryan that was really popular. So we sung at most of the popular. I'm sorry, I can't remember some of the clubs no more. It's been a long time ago.
So, how long were the Flares together? Because I know that you ended up having another group a few years later called Velvet. Is that
exactly
right? So what's the story? Did the Flares just become Velvet, or what happened?
The Flares became Velvet. I came up with the name Velvet because everybody was gone then except for me. And I was the originator of the Flares. So when I met James Porter because I liked the 8 Minutes. I would hear their stuff playing on the radio, and he was getting songs played. And I thought that was so cool. And the group he had then with Heather Sutter and a few people, I liked their songs. I liked their sound. I liked Mr. Porter's arrangements. And some kind of way I got in touch with him, or we met some kind of way. I can't remember how. I can't even remember that. I'm going to have to ask him the next time I talk to him. Does he remember? But anyway, when we got with him, he liked my songwriting ability. By this time, I was writing songs. I could write a song. I won't say I knew what I was doing, but I was in more control of what I was saying. I knew what I was saying. And he really liked, he saw the potential in me. And so he introduced me to the 8 Minutes, and he looked at me then as a songwriter for them. So that's what he did. And 8 Minutes they sung one of my first songs. I used to walk in the streets and sing, called Next Time She'll Be Good.
Yeah, that was a nice one of their better records that they did too.
It was.
So so he initially had you as a songwriter for them.
Right.
And did he know about your group that you had, the Flares?
Yeah, he knew about the groups and everything. And when I told him, but the group, we was always rehearsing and practicing to do shows. So even though I was writing for the 8 Minutes, my group, the Flares, which we were still called the Flares then, we would go out and do shows at different clubs and different places for pay.
Okay.
You know, it wouldn't be much, but it'd be a little something. And them days, we was happy to get anything. We'd go get some barbecue and something to drink, and we was cool.
Okay.
It was fun. And so then I came to Porter and let him know about the group and everything. So he said, He wanted to hear us, so I brought him to his house, and we sung a couple of songs for him and blew him away. And he loved it. And so then when we got ready to actually record something, he was going to record us while he was recording the 8 Minutes. I changed the name of the group so we could be a fresh new group through him.
Okay.
And we called ourselves Velvet.
So do you remember, what was the lineup of Velvet, the same five guys you just...
Okay, the Velvet was Quinn, me, Walter Outley. Wow.
Was your brother?
Dijon. No, my brother was nowhere in the picture then. Walter Hughes. And it was four of us. I think it was just four of us. It was Quinn. It seemed like Du Bois was with us, too. I think Du Bois was. Du Bois was with us, too. So it was Du Bois, Shelton, Walter Outley, Quinn, me,
Walter Hughes.
And Walter Hughes. So we were Velvet.
So there are five members in Velvet.
Right. It was four originally, then Quinn came along. I always liked Quinn. He was so talented. He could play guitar, too. He was like George Benson. And I put him in the group. So then it became five of us, and we were Velvet.
So he cut a record on you called Give It Up.
Yes.
And it got released, I think, around 1972, is that right?
Exactly. It was in the 70s, because we were still into Bruce Lee and all of that. In 69, I love Bruce Lee. I still love him to this day. But we were always at the movies when that happened, because that was very popular. We all liked the karate movie. We call them the Karats. And Mr. Porter, I loved Mr. Porter because he was so sincere with music. I used to love to watch him. This is where I learned how to arrange my own music. This is where I learned how to go in the studio and record. I still wasn't really great at producing, but I was learning how to arrange music and watch how he put it together. Mr. Porter, he was really, really good. I've always respected him for this to this day. And this is where I first started learning, and we came up with Give It Up. And
so you're saying you wrote it with James Porter?
Yes. James Porter wrote the music. I wrote the lyric. And one thing I want to say, when that song came out, I remember I was still sleeping outside. Isn't that something? I still was homeless. And I found an abandoned house. And I remember going into the house. I broke the boards off the window to the bedroom. It was a big house, too. And I remember going in the bedroom, and it was a mattress already on the floor. So I liked that. And then I had a little orange crate for my little table, and I had a little transistor radio about the size of your hand, palm of your hand, and I would always set it on the orange crate when I come from Mr. Porter's for practicing or something. He would always drive. Where you mean drop off tonight, Kenny? I said, drive me over right here. And I go in there, and I fall asleep. I had a little blanket, a little too in there, and I remember I went with him 2 weeks before it actually came out, and I watched him go to E. Rodney Jones at WVON, and he did some business with him, and he got that record played, man. And I remember waking up one morning, and I thought I was dreaming, and I could hear da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, jump-bum-bum. And I was waking up, I was going, I know that. Where I heard that song before? And then when I actually woke up, it's my song. I remember I grabbed that transistor radio, man, and I ran down. I jumped out the window and ran down the street, just jumping up and down and having the transistor to my ear, listening to that song. And I cried. That was the greatest moment. Even if I was homeless and didn't have my mama and my daddy and my brothers and sister and all that, didn't have no food, that song, that was God showing me, I got you. He said, I got you, Kenny. So do it. He got me today.
That must have been exciting hearing
that. That was the most exciting moment of my life, to hear me on the radio with a more professional sound, because the stylistics was happening then and Blue Magic was happening then. And when my song came on, it fit right in, too. That song was a good song.
Yeah, it had more of like a 70s kind of, like early 70s.
70s, exactly. It came on WVON at number 40, and it made it to number 8. That's how good it was. And it played maybe 4 or 5 times a day. And I would be walking the streets, because I was out there, and I would hear it play on people's cars. I would see kids playing it on their little radio boxes. And it was a great feeling, great feeling. Oh, God, that was the most. That was the best, man.
And one thing is, the record actually came out on 2 record labels. I think originally he got it released on Love Light Records, which was, I think, Clarence Johnson's label, and then he had it on Perception.
I couldn't figure that one out. I'm glad you said that. Clarence Johnson, I miss him, too. Is he still around?
Yeah, he's still around, too.
I hope he's listening to this show, because I like Clarence. Clarence was good, too. He had that group called Brighter Side of Darkness, and they had a nice hit. They was on Soul Train, everything. But Clarence was good. He liked the music, too. And I think he had a lot to do with the Shy Lights in the beginning.
Yeah, he was an original singer in the Shy Lights. He sang bass.
That's what it was. He taught me a song that I taught the group about something about tears on the pillow or something. I still like to sing it. He taught us that in Shelton's hotel in the lobby where the piano was.
So you don't know how it first came out on his label and then on Perception. Was it that he cut it as a demo and then as
well? You know what? He knew Shelton.
Okay.
So if he was with the Shy Lights, then he had something to do with those tracks.
Okay, but it was Jim Porter's name on the
record. I know, because, like I said, Jim produced it.
Okay.
But I don't know the business end of how them two got together. But it was cool because I knew Mr. Porter, and I also knew Clarence Johnson.
And Perception was the large national label.
In New York, and they had Black Ivory and a lot of groups out there from New York, and they were good. And they was in that 70s mode, too.
Yeah, and the 8 minutes, he had gotten the 8 minutes on
And he got them with Perception also.
Well, let me play the record, and we could talk some more.
Okay.
So this is Velvet with their first record called Give It Up. Okay, that was just Velvet, who I guess evolved out of the Flares, and that was their first record called Give It Up. And if you're just tuning in, I have on the phone Kenneth Jones, who was lead singer of Velvet and the Flares, telling his story. So that record, we were talking, came out around 72, 73, something like that?
Exactly.
And you said it actually got, that was your biggest hit as a group, right?
Right. It started at number 40, and it made it to number 8, and I'll never forget that. What I liked about it, it wasn't the fact that it just made it to number 8. It was, they used to play the Silvers behind us. So I used to like that, because the Silvers was nationally known. So they used to play Fool's Paradise.
Yeah, which also had a nice harmony, nice 70s harmony.
Yeah, and that was modern harmony, and that was your 70s sound, too.
So did you start getting bigger shows once that record came out?
When that record came out, Porter had us do a lot of bigger shows. We used to play the Times Square, which was cool then, and Herb Kent was, we would do shows for Herb Kent and a few people. We did Believe it or not, we did not the Big Bill Hill Show, but the Don Cornelius.
The local Chicago Soul Train.
Yeah, that. And that was big for us because that was TV. He was actually on TV. Do you remember, what was their name? They made, you got to know them. It'll come to me. But we started doing shows like opening up for people like Isaac Hayes, B.B. King. We started opening up for people like that on shows. Especially when we would do variety shows, we would were able to play with the guy Ernie Terrell in the heavyweights.
Yeah,
remember Ernie Terrell fought Muhammad Ali.
Yeah, and his sister was Jean Terrell.
Jean Terrell, that's right. So, did she sign with the Supremes? Didn't she? Wasn't she one of the Supremes at one time?
Yes,
exactly. And I was always able to meet people. I met Jackie Wilson, Amal Jamal. Jackie Wilson was going to do one of my songs called Choose. That I used to play all the time back in the day. And I got a chance to meet him and his wife and his son. And for some reason, I was running around with Gus Redman, who I heard on your show. You interviewed him. I sure like to get in touch with him. But he was always really cool. He took me up to Brunswick, and he introduced me to Otis LaVille, and I met the Shylights. I met Marshall. And Marshall liked me, and I remember there was a lot of other people. Barbara Acklin,
yeah,
is she still around?
She died like five,
wow.
6 years ago.
Wow.
But yeah, she was at Brunswick. So,
yeah.
So did you write for anyone else that recorded besides the 8 minutes in the early 70s?
The Artistics worked on some of my stuff. I used to go to their house. I just loved the Artistics. I wrote a song for them called Who Invented Cupid.
Was that released?
I don't think it ever got released.
Okay.
I got a chance to really work with them and professionally. And then I did a lot of commercials with Chuck Colbert. I miss him. I would like to see him. He was the one that actually sent me out to California.
And he was with the Daylighters before he got into advertising.
He was with Daylighters, and he also
the American
was
Breed.
That made Bend Me, Shape Me, yeah, anyway.
It's the American Breed.
The American Breed, thank you.
Yeah.
He played bass. And I used to always tease him because he was black, but he looked like a Mexican, and they was white, so he kind of blended in with them. And he took care of me. He was one of the first people to actually give me a place to stay. They had a million sellers, so he had a beautiful home. I think I don't want to hope I'm not quoting. If I'm wrong, then I'm sorry, but I think he bought the home for his mother and father. And Charlie's Chicken was what his father had. So maybe his father probably, because they were doing well up in Roseland. But anyway, Chuck let me stay there, and Chuck was doing a movie called No Place to Run. And he had people like the Shylights in there, and I played, this was my attempt to acting. So I played a junkie in a wheelchair with no legs and one arm. Can you believe that? Me?
Did the movie get released, or he was just producing it?
I don't know how far I got with that. I know I shot, which I looked at rushes. I was with Chuck all the time because I lived with him. And something happened. Well, with Give It Up got to number 8. I hadn't seen my mother in years, 2 or 3 years. And I bumped into my brother. And he used to take care of me sometime. He'd give me money and food and everything. And I got sick, real sick out there. And he told my mother. My mother said, well, tell him to come home. So I went to her, and she took care of me for a month. I'll never forget it. And that was one of the nice things she did with me at that time. And then she convinced me that, you know, if my songs are doing that well and I'm writing songs, take a chance. I go to California, step out there, and I did. That's what I did.
So, actually, Velvet had released one more record on Perception called Bet You If You Ask Around. Do you remember recording that record?
No, and I tell you what, that was somebody else. What we recorded, which was the other side of Give It Up, was...
It's the Right Thing to Do.
The Right Thing to Do.
But then they released another record called Bet You If You Ask Around that I sent to you. You said it's not you guys singing on it?
Yeah, it's not us. I don't know. So I don't know how that happened. That was something done with Jim Porter, because I asked him tonight. I was talking with him yesterday. And he was saying that's his song.
Because another group called the Quadrophonics later did a different version. But you're saying on your version it's not actually Velvet singing.
No, I don't know who that was. Well, he did tell me who that was. That was, he told me that was somebody's son that he knew that's pretty popular. It was someone's son that he knew. I can't say anything on that because I don't know anything about that until... I remember the song. I remember hearing the song when I was still in Chicago, but it wasn't enough.
So your mom encouraged you to go to... So did the group just break up after that? What happened?
Wow, that's deep. What happened with us, all of us? I wanted to go and they couldn't go.
Okay.
That's what it was.
So what year did you go to California?
75. That I won't forget.
And what did you do when you got to California?
When I got to California, my brother was in the Navy. That's what happened. He went to the Navy, and Danny went to the Marines or something, and Pete and Dijon. Dijon, I think, now is a detective, or he was a detective. And that kind of broke us up. And then, like I said, my girlfriend was pregnant and with our first son, Pierre. And it didn't pan out with me and her at the time. So I was just out there by myself. And then when I got sick and I went home, my mother took care of me. And she convinced me I should take a chance and go to California with my talents. So I did. And when I got here, I stayed with my brother in San Diego.
Which of your brothers was in California?
Lauren Jones, okay. The one that used to sing with me.
Okay.
And then when I got there, after about 2 or 3 months, I got in touch with James Porter. And he hooked me, or was it Pepe? Homer Talbot that wrote for Jerry Butler.
Yeah, he wrote Eight Understanding Mellow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I used to live with them when I was in the street sometimes. You know, some people would say, oh, you can come and you can stay here for a little while until you get on your feet type of deal. But so Pepe told me to come to L.A. He said I was in the wrong place at San Diego because, you know, all the people that was into music and the business was in L.A. So I went up there on the bus and got with Pepe. And Pat also sings for Smokey now, but at the time she wasn't. And they were with some of the group members of Earth, Wind & Fire.
Okay.
So I know Louis Satterfield, Hipmo, that played saxophone for, that did Reasons for Earth, Wind & Fire.
Yeah.
I knew them from being in Chicago. I would hang out with them. And, they taught me a lot. I mean, what black was really all about at the time.
They were making kind of conscious.
Yeah, they were used
music.
To be the Pharaoh.
Yeah, which was all like kind of Afro heritage.
All
black.
That. And so that's what I learned about who I was as a black man. They threw them. I'll never forget them for that. And James Walker, Louis Satterfield, Donald Myrick. That's the one that he passed. I really loved Donald Myrick. He played saxophone, and I would go everywhere with them. They would always let me go with them. They even recorded behind me a couple of songs, and they had me sing on stage a couple of times with them. I can't think of the name of the club at that time that they used to play at with Charles Keys, who played trumpet, and they were great. I loved them at the time, Pharaohs. And then next thing I know, they was Earth, Wind & Fire.
Were you in L.A. at that time? What city were you in?
I was in Chicago, but then when I got to L.A., they were up in L.A. too.
So you were staying in L.A. and hanging out with the Earth, Wind & Fire at the
I was
time?
There, I was hanging out with them, Louis Satterfield, Donald Myrick. I used to always go to his house. And I remember when I first got here, I went to the Hollywood Bowl. They were there, and I never forget. I cried looking at them. I can remember them in Chicago, and there they were getting out of limousines, and people was going crazy, and they were singing Reasons, and I was so proud of them. I was so glad that I knew them. But what happened was when I got with Homer Talbot and Pat Henley, they gave a party, and I was living with them. They gave a party. And Smokey Robinson's sister came to the party. They was tight with Woody, Rosella Jones, that's Smokey's sister. She wrote Quiet Storm, Can You Love a Virgin Man, and all those songs. And they wanted her to hear me. So they had a piano. I played maybe 2 or 3 songs, and then I did a little stand-up for about maybe 20 minutes. and got a standing ovation, and they was just like, she was really crazy about me. So she pulled me to the side. She said, Kenneth, you got to meet my brother. I said, who's your brother? And she goes, Smokey Robinson. And he's my idol, you know what I'm saying? I was still into that frame of mind. When I first started skating, roller skating in Michigan, I used to skate to I Got a Lover Way Over There, those kind of songs. And I always loved Smokey, because I loved his cleverness of writing. So anyway, it took Smokey a year to audition me, because she said, I'm going to tell him about you. And it took him a year to finally have the time to audition me. And what he did was once he called me, she called me and told me to be at his house in Beverly Hills. And I was scared to death, because if I thought I was something, I would know now for a fact. Because people around you will say, oh, you're good, oh, you got some talent. Bro. And you don't know if they're telling you the truth or what. You have to really believe in yourself. And I knew that once I went to him and he told me or dealt with me, then I knew it was true. That's funny how that is. I had all this talent, but I still didn't know who I was or how good I was until I got to his house that night. And when I remember getting in there and I sat in the corner, and I thought that was heaven. Beautiful studio, beautiful mansion, and I just found the corner and sat on the floor. I swear, man, and I thought I was in heaven.
What year was that, you think?
76. Okay. 76. Because I got out here in 75, so it took me a year to get with Smoke. So, yeah, about 76, 77.
So you auditioned for Smokey, and was he auditioning you as an artist, or what was the deal?
He auditioned me as a writer. He was looking for a songwriter. At the time, he was writing, Ivy Stone was writing for him, which her husband did, Car Wash. He was a producer and writer. Mark Davis, he was out of Chicago, too. We used to do shows with him at Phillips. And his sister, Rosella, who wrote Quiet Storm. And he also auditioned for backup singers, too, because he was in the tour. So, and then he needed a drummer, so he auditioned for a drummer, too. So when my turn came, I remember getting up, and quickly he said, he took me into another part of the studio, and this is when I first was close up on him, one-on-one. It was just me and him. And he put on glasses. He was biting his tongue. I couldn't believe it. I said, oh, people don't even know you do this, man. And I remember he had me play. He said, just go ahead and play. I had my little booklet together. I was trying to be as professional as I could be. And he said, go ahead and play. And so I started playing. And I played. Every song I played, he would not smile. He would not do anything. He wouldn't show nothing. Then I would go, okay, well, listen to this one. And it was blowing his mind, but I didn't know that. And so the fifth song I played was Mr. Postman. Okay? And when I got through playing that, he couldn't hold it anymore. He laughed. He actually laughed. And he goes, how would you like to be an exclusive songwriter for me? And I said, sure. Yeah, I was blown away. And he told me the next day, he told me, he was at his pool, and he was sitting there braiding his own hair. I ain't never seen a man braid his own hair. And I came over there to him, and he said, you know what, Kenny? You remind me so much of myself. He said, what we went through last night, I went through the same thing with Berry Gordy. He said, I had 300 songs when I met Berry. I had 400 when I met Smokey. So that's how I got with Smokey.
So did you sign with him or with Motown?
I signed with him as an exclusive songwriter for Motown. I got my checks from Motown.
And so what songs did you write for him that ended up being recorded?
The first song that I wrote for him was, he did a movie called Big Time, and I wrote the theme to the movie, If We're Gonna Act Like Lovers. And it's on the beach scene where Jane Kennedy and... Christopher Joy. He was in that movie, too. Christopher Joy and the guy, Roger E. Mosley, that used to be in Magnum P.I., the helicopter guy.
Okay.
Black guy. He was in the movie, too. And it was a good movie. It really was. It was one of those black movies, but it was good, you know.
Let me play the record, and we can talk some more. So this is the first record you wrote for Smokey, and this is the first record you wrote for anyone else besides the 8 minutes that was released. Is that right?
Exactly. This is the first person.
And this is called If We're Gonna Act Like Lovers.
Yeah, this is the soundtrack to the movie.
Okay, you're tuned to WHBK 88.5 FM in Chicago. That was just Smokey Robinson with If We're Gonna Act Like Lovers from the Big Time soundtrack. The track was written by Kenneth Jones, who you've been listening to an interview from. His phone was having problems, so hopefully we'll get him back on the air to finish his story. Let me see if that's him. Hello?
Yeah.
Is this Kenneth?
Yes.
You're back on the air now.
Okay.
It was good timing. The song just faded, and you just called right when it finished, and I was talking about it. So you're back on the air right now. So
That's God. That's all it is. It's just my father. I love it.
So that was just Smokey Robinson with If We're Gonna Act Like Lovers, and you must have been excited when your material that you wrote for him finally came out.
Yeah, that was so fantastic for me. It was a real wonderful experience writing for Smokey, and because Smokey, I learned so much from him. I wanted him to be like a mentor to me. I really did, but I didn't know how to deal with him that way. He just took me like I was a little puppy. He kind of took me to the side, and he was showing me things, but he was so busy. But he did teach me, critique my songwriting ability. I'm a natural-born songwriter, so that's what I do. I'm a tunesmith. Okay, I got songs, spiritual, country, whatever I feel, because I can't read or write, so I'm not bogged down with rules. I just write what I feel and keep myself available for God to have me say whatever he wants me to say that's going to be good and healthy for mankind and the children.
So how long did you stay with Smokey? What years were you together from, like, you said that was 76 you started with him?
I got with him in 76, but I think that came out in 77, 78, 79, 80, 81, 82, about 82, 83, then that's when we split up.
So you worked with him for 5 years?
Yes.
Did he release a lot of records you wrote?
He recorded a lot of records I wrote.
Okay.
That's a game they play. They try to get as much material as they can until you grow up or until you realize business. I didn't know business, and Smokey's thing was he didn't have the time to teach me that. So when he needed a song, he would call me, and I would go over there and sit at his piano and play, and then he'd say, I like that song. I want that song. That kind of thing. And he was trying to, but he would let me record. I recorded with Ozone out of Motown. They would, was my rhythm band to go in and record songs for Smokey's publishing company, which I really wasn't aware of that. I really didn't know what I was doing. All I did was he let me record. He told me, you can go in the studio, Kenny. He said, yeah, you get these guys, I'll pay for them and go. And then what he was doing was putting songs in his publishing company of mine. So it was that kind of a thing. And then when he needed a song for me that he wanted to do to actually put on his albums, then he would call me for that. So that's what I did with them. But I learned a lot from him, and it was very rewarding to write for Smokey and pick up on things that he taught me. Like one thing I want to say, what he taught me, just to show you, when I say he taught me how to critique my writing ability. He taught me one thing. All people out there, writers, especially songwriters out there, Smokey taught me that you can't just write songs for the community. You have to really think worldwide and universal. And one of my songs I wrote, I would say, I dig the way you spend time sharing what's on your sweet mind. Right? Smokey said, why do you say dig, Kenny? And that's what I said. Remember, we was right on. I can dig that, you know. And he said, well, don't you want Frank Sinatra to sing your song? Don't you want people to cover your song? And I said, yeah. He said, well, then you should say like instead of dig, because like is universal. Chinese understand like. Eskimos understand like. Africans understand like. So those were the kind of things he would do with me as I wrote for him and was learning how to write, to know how to write a song.
And he did release more records that you wrote,
yeah,
right?
He did another song I wrote called I'm Loving You Softly.
Okay.
Which did pretty good. I got a nice write up in Billboard as new fresh blood for Smokey Robinson.
So
I thought that was pretty cool.
So after, and did you write anything for other Motown people that recorded? Like, did you write any Ozone records that were released?
No, I didn't do anything with Ozone. Once I did the Smokey thing, and I left Smokey because it got a little tough, but it was cool. I left Smokey and got with Barney Perkins, who is an engineer and producer himself, but he's known as an engineer in the business. He's like one of the top five engineers in the world. Barney took me in. My brother, Lauren Jones, took out a loan on his house and gave me about maybe $28,000 to record myself. And Barney took me in because he was the one that engineered those songs that I have on Smokey. He was the engineer. And he did the mixing and the mastering. He's one of the best in the world. He did Marvin Gaye, Anita Baker, The Whispers, Smokey, you know, The Supreme, So Tops. Barney was, he's bad. And he took me in and taught me how to produce myself. And I did a CD and almost had a record deal with Lark Records that he got for me. I'll never forget that. And he taught me a lot. And this is where, you know, I just want to say, Dinell Glover and him introduced me to the studio. Jim Porter, James Porter, he taught me how to coordinate and arrange music in the studio. And then Smokey taught me how to critique my songwriting, because the word is powerful. I mean, every word you say when you're writing a song means, should mean something. And Smokey said he was taught that by Berry Gordy. And Smokey taught me that. If you say I, and it, those words are supposed to mean something and not just to rhyme with something. And then when I got with Barney Perkins, he taught me how to produce myself. So the songs that you have...
So the song like Mr. Postman, that's what you recorded with him.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Which we're running really low on time, which I would play, but I don't have time to play, but it's a great record. You said that it was... you said it wasn't... You recorded it. Was it ever released?
Yes, Postman was released, and
what year was it?
It was on a 12-inch. It was on a 12-inch, and those remember the times when they had 12-inch.
So you released it as by Kenneth Jones on a 12-inch.
Yes.
On what year and what record label?
That was on my record label, Soft Soul Records.
Was it in like 1983, something like that?
Yeah, it was in the 80s, and it played all over overseas and everywhere. I mean, I had some decent airplay. I was with Mekola Distributors.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. Because it's a great song actually, and I could either play that or play something from your new CD. And I think you want me to play something from your new CD.
Yeah, just so people can hear what I'm doing today.
So really quickly, so that came out in the mid 80s, sometime like that. And then what have you done since then up to today?
Up to the day since then, when that came out, I've been working and trying, and I've been doing shows. You know, I've been playing at the Hilton out here resort. I've been playing at places like Morgan's Run, which is a big resort, hotel resort, deal with horses and golf and all of that. And I've been playing a lot of nice places like that, and that's great for me. And while I've been doing that, I've been trying to take my own little money now and just get this project that I'm working on now, which one of the songs you'll play, happening. And I got with Nelson Campbell. He has Top Dog Records, or Top Dog Entertainment, and he's been helping me get marketed. And so now I'm on YouTube, and I'm on MySpace, and I just did a video 3 weeks ago, and my goal now is to get marketed this CD that we have getting ready to come out now.
So it's not released yet?
No.
And you never released any material since Mr. Postman in the mid-80s?
No, because I've been performing. I've just been concentrating on performing and working, trying to... you know, get my life together. It's really been rough. It's really been up and down. But now that I can perform in decent places, that's been a joy for me. So now I'm ready to, you know, get the CD out. And it's taken me a while because I'm financing myself.
Okay. And so I only have like a few minutes left to play the track. I'm going to play a track called What About Love. But before I play, so this will be the last time we're on there right now. Is there something that people should look for? They can look for your MySpace page, is that right?
Right. They can go to my MySpace, and they can go to YouTube and check me out there, and then that'll link them to other things about me, other areas about me. My website is Net Zero, Kenneth Jones, netzero@.com. Net Zero. I'm not good at all accounts.
People should definitely look out for your material, and
right.
I'll let everybody know. And do you have any last words for the audience, or should I just play the track now?
You said you got a few minutes. Go
there's
ahead.
There's 2 minutes
I hope
left.
Somebody out there heard me. I hope I've said something that might help somebody else going through the same thing. And just stick with what you're doing, you know, and trust God and keep the faith.
Okay, well, this is a track from your new CD, which hasn't come out yet, but people should look for.
Right, and the song you're finna play, What About Love, is the one that we're going to market.
Okay, here it is.